ready to keep you company wherever you are. Carte Blanche, the podcast, brings you immersive, hard-hitting stories anytime, anywhere, every week.
It's Monday and congrats on surviving the madness of this past election weekend. With us this week is DM168 editor Heather Robertson, and you're in for a lively discussion. Here's what's coming your way on this week's installment of The Whole Week Wrap with Daily Maverick and Carte Blanche. South Africa officially enters a new political era. So now what? Then the IEC takes a battering as voters and some political parties say, we expected better. Later, we ask what more needs to happen before the humanitarian crisis in Gaza gets the urgent attention it deserves.
I think I can commend our government for the international court action that they've taken. But unfortunately, the American government is still fully behind Israel. It's an absolute tragedy.
And a new medical trial could change the way we handle everything from dentistry to bone disease. But first, it's the big C word many of us have been anticipating. As the IEC declares this year's election results, coalition negotiations are already in high gear. And with Jacob Zuma's MK party kicking dust in the faces of many major political parties, the intricate coalition game is sure to deliver a few more surprises.
Heather, welcome back to the show. How are you doing now that Election Day is officially behind us?
I'm doing fine, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm good. I must say, I was quite anxious in the days leading up to the 29th of May because literally the night before, I still wasn't sure who I was going to vote for or how I was going to split my vote. But I'm just happy it's behind me. I'm just following the outcomes from the elections. Yeah.
You know, I do the same. I thought I was very sure, and then I wasn't so sure. And then literally in the voting booth, I changed one of my votes.
A lot of people have done the same. So, of course, this will be an elections-focused show. I mean, it can't be anything else. And I think this was probably the most nail-biting election for many reasons. I want us to start with the MK party, which, I mean, I still can't wrap my head around the fact that they launched in December last year. And we saw them sailing through in KZN and doing some damage in Mpumalanga and Gauteng as well. I think a lot of people maybe underestimated them. Even members within the ANC, I saw Gwede Mantashe on Thursday saying that they are surprised by the MK support. Another party that's making some inroads is the Patriotic Alliance that's kind of biting at the heels of the DA in the Western Cape. So what's your take on the results?
I don't think I'm surprised by MK. All the polls were saying that they would actually get quite a good size of the votes. And I'm thinking of one of our reporters was at the results center in the Midrand, interviewed Jacob Zuma's daughter, Duduzile. And she was saying they're not surprised because they knew that many people would be wearing ANC T-shirts but would actually vote MK. So it was the silent ANC vote. But I mean, is the MK vote, because it's particularly in Gauteng, it's in KZN and it's big and in Mpumalanga, is the MK vote a disaffected ANC vote? Is it a faction of the ANC vote? Because remember what Zuma and these RET faction and state capture faction, is it a vote for more patronage, or is it a vote for Zulu nationalism, or is it a vote because we got followed the ANC and we want to show Cyril Ramaphosa that we can beat you at your own game and we're not going to, what are we going to show you? So it's unclear to me. Is it a bit of all of it? So for me, the interesting thing about the MK party is, why are people actually voting for them? The face of Jacob Zuma, the man who we know was deeply involved in state capture, the man who handed over the keys to our kingdom to the Guptas, the man who still stands accused in the arms deal. What is it? What is this man's attraction to all these people who have voted? I mean, look at the party. The person who registered the party has been suspended and kicked out. The members of the party are at loggerheads with each other. The only person that seems to be standing is Jacob Zuma, who himself cannot actually be in the legislature or in parliament. He won't be able to be the president or an MP. So the only person whose voice I'm hearing with clarity, even though, you know, it's highly questionable, is his daughter. His daughter speaking on behalf of him. His daughter says, oh, Barbara will decide who will be premier and who will have what positions.
I remember political analyst Tessa Dooms in an interview with an American publication said, quote, there is almost a Trumpian type of moment that's developing where people are resisting establishment politics because they feel like those parties are far removed from them, are not accountable to them, and are not engaged with them. And I think to an extent, that's why voters perhaps are gravitating towards Zuma and also to Gaetan McKenzie, who's also this very colorful, loud character.
Just hold that thought. What is more establishment or what is less establishment than Jacob Zuma? The man was president for just under two terms. The man worked as an MEC. The man was deputy president of the country.
But we know people in South Africa have they have short memories in South Africa, unfortunately. And I think because you touched on it and you said that perhaps he's made himself this victim. And similar to Trump, the Zuma supporters believe that he's being persecuted by these shadowy figures. You know, we have spies and poisoning and all of that. And that he should actually be the rightful leader of the country. Just as yourself, I'm trying to figure this out because it, for me as well, it makes no sense why you would vote of state capture.
How did this man, how did he get into power, right? He was the victim of Thabo Mbeki and the accusations, the rape accusations. I mean, the man is archaic in his thinking. In fact, it's quite interesting. This party, it wrecks the very progressive values that are in the constitution that his former party that brought him into the public spotlight, the ANC, actually fought for. What are they saying in this MK party? They want to kill the constitution, 100%. They are anti-gays. You know, all those rights that we've managed to win under the ANC, toss it out. No. You know, men must be men and women must be women. And, you know, parliament must have all the say, just like in the apartheid times. He wants to take us to the past. He wants to bury us in the past. He wants to reclaim the land, but tribal authorities must be in charge of it. I mean, already we have that with an Ingonyama trust in KZN, and he wants the whole country to be like that. So is he preying on the sentiments of those people who have been denied services, denied any opportunity to grow or develop during the 30 years of ANC rule, of which he was part of? So I'm thinking there's a lot. I'm thinking this vote, another possibility, that this vote is telling us the people who benefited from state capture, who feel that their access to the purse is now going to be denied, they're voting for Zuma so that they can still collect more. Yeah, that's one. Yeah. The other one is perhaps, you know, the new leader of the IFP is not as visible as Mangosuthu Buthelezi. Zuma was a president. Vilenkosi is not a president. He's an unknown factor. And so people are voting for someone who's popular and speaks the language, you know.
Looking at this year's election results, one thing is clear. Voters have had enough of the usual suspects. With political parties like the Patriotic Alliance, led by controversial figure Gaetan McKenzie, and the MK party winning over large chunks of the South African voter base, we look at how the nature of South African politics has changed and why the big players have no choice but to change the way they do things.
This also takes us nicely into the whole concept of identity politics, as is the case with Zuma and the MK party, and also populist politics, as seen with the PA and the EFF, just jumping from one topic to the other, whatever gets them the most views at any specific time. So I think for a long time, there's been this sense, and maybe this is just me being very naive, but there's been this sense that South Africans steer a little bit closer towards centrist policies, but that seems to be changing.
So, okay, the ANC is left centrist. The DA, I would argue, is right centrist. The EFF is left. MK is delusional. The Patriotic Alliance is definitely right. far yes. right. I mean, bring back the death penalty, but definitely playing into the colored vote because people, again, are half full of crime. But why are they voting for a former gangster? I don't know. It's, you know, it's kind of like, it's like all of this is quite, it's interesting. And I think these populists who speak in the language of the people, that's why they're winning votes. I think the EFF has actually matured. They want special economic zones and give businesses incentives to be there. I think that's pretty interesting. That's different. And I think there are some, yeah, there's some pretty intelligent people in the EFF as well. And like, yeah, people are going to hate me for saying this. But guys, compare what we have in the EFF to what we have in MK. Please compare it. This is what I'm talking about. So yes, the population of this country are still voting centrists, if you look at the ANC and the DA leading.
I want to try and wrap up this section of the chat by just kind of getting your thoughts on the ANC and the DA specifically, because I suspect that this year has probably been a massive wake-up call for them. Voters simply are not voting for the bigger parties just because that's the way it's always been. That voters are now actually enforcing their right to choose. And so I'm wondering, do you see the ANC and the DA and the EFF in part changing the way they approach politics in the next few years before the next general elections? Because right now they both seem kind of lost in this very different looking political arena.
I mean, it's too early days now, but I'm sure the one thing I do want to say is the ANC and the DA are too arrogant. We need to actually shake up power so that people can get a little bit of humility and realize what it really is about. It's not about you staying in power. It's about you serving the people of the country. They need to actually engage with the communities and get down with the people and understand what their real issues and concerns are. And don't be patronizing. I really think the DA does need to have a strong reflection on how it deals with, I mean, yes, it is a diverse party, but how does it actually deal with diverse communities, in particular poor black and brown communities? Mm. So you cannot have this arrogance. I mean, like the president of the ANC is like, I mean, billionaire. Look, it's super wealthy, rich people who are out of touch with the ordinary people. And that's what the MK party is doing today. It's giving it a wake up. Hey, you know, we're not on your level. We're not floating on cloud nine. So take notice of us. I think it's a good wake up call. It's a bit, the scenarios, post-election scenarios will just be a bit worrying. If the MK party wins KZN outright or it goes into a coalition with the EFF and say the Patriotic Alliance, I mean, wow. But look, and this other thing is this multi-party charter, which is kind of like a centrist right-wing charter, if you think about it. So far, they're not getting anywhere close to what an ANC alliance with the EFF and God forbid, ANC, I don't know why the ANC would want to join with the MK party, but anyway, let's say do, yes, because there's probably people in the ANC who still support Jacob Zuma. And
but MK and Duduzile has, in any case, said on Thursday that we're not considering a coalition with the ANC at all. But at the end of the day, power and positions speak.
Positions, so money, salary, job for 5 years.
Right, exactly.
And but then also the leader of the party gets much more than everybody else sitting in parliament. Wonder who that will be because it can't be Zuma.
No, it definitely can't. So it'll be interesting to see who steps up. Maybe it's Duduzile for all we know.
That would be like, oh yeah, I'll start watching parliament more often.
Late delivery of ballots. Endless queues that moved at a snail's pace and systems riddled with glitches. Many voters can agree that this year's voting processes were grueling. But what really went wrong on voting day and what lessons can the IEC learn?
We can't wrap up our elections chat without looking at the role of the IEC, because a lot of people have been talking about that as well. Yes. There's no denying they could have done things better. I know a lot of people are saying that the 281 million rand budget cut certainly didn't help matters. But then there are others saying that the IEC should have then done more to mitigate the anticipated issues, knowing full well that they had less to work with. Now, from my own experience, the process process was pretty flawless. I was in and out within 15 minutes, but I have family and friends who queued anything from an hour to 6 hours on the day. What was your experience like? Let's first get that out of the way.
So I live in Pretoria and I voted at the Linwood Ridge Primary School. So I was about an hour and a half in the queue. It was much longer than I'd waited in 2019. But when I got in there, it worked pretty efficiently. I had to catch the Gautrain to go to Johannesburg at 5 o'clock. You know, my heart really went out to the university students. They were queuing round the block, the University of Pretoria students, and they were still apparently queuing till like 3 o'clock in the morning.
Yes, I mean, that same was, at Vets, I mean,
that's
as well.
Highly, highly inefficient. And the problems they were saying was with the scanners.
Yeah, the tablets.
Scanners. Mm. And then it's like, I mean, why don't they just move quicker to the printed out voters roll, which they do have?
Because some only started doing that in the evening.
Yes.
So they've been battling the whole day and no one thought that maybe this is what we should do.
It's like, which can is you bizarre. Pivot quickly? Can you pivot like when, the minute it's not working, pivot? It's also like someone told me they went into a voting station and then they asked him like, but like, what's happening? Why are we? Said, no, we didn't charge the scanners. Why do you not think to charge scanners? And I think the problem is that there was, I think, where it worked efficiently, I think those people were trained very well.
Yes.
Where it did not work efficiently, I don't think those people were trained efficiently enough. Mm. I think they should have had a bit more foresight, planned ahead. It's like, listen, give the instruction to the presiding officers. The equipment's not working. Let's go manual. Let's go to the voters roll, get people through.
Yes. And I read a piece on Daily Maverick discussing exactly this topic about the IEC and what went wrong. And Groundwork Collective CEO Mbali Ntuli told Daily Maverick journalist Lerato Motsila that the IEC shouldn't take all the blame necessarily because she says, quote, Parliament and political parties must also shoulder some blame, particularly for how they handled legislation that has come out late in the game, forcing the IEC to scramble. So it's a multi-layered issue of blame, but I do agree with you absolutely. They should have planned better for the new system, the three-ballot system. And when things started going wrong, they should have had plans in place to be like, okay, right, this is not working. Let's switch. Let's just do it. Let's get it out of the way. Instead of waiting from, let's say, 9 a.m. in the morning and only switching to the manual process at 6, 7 p.m. in the evening.
Yeah.
I mean, there's absolutely no excuse for that happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I do think Mbali is right. And look, it's a very cumbersome system. I hope it's going to be tweaked in the next 5 years. And look, kudos to the IEC for actually pulling this off again. It has been pulled off. And like those people work day and night and they did do their best. But, you know, there were some who should have actually got the act together. Like, and also parts where there were not enough ballot papers and that sort of thing. Those things should be planned for, could have been planned for better as well. But on the whole, they did an amazing job. They really did. And hey, on the whole, voters did an amazing job because freaking hell, to stand in those queues so early in the morning, from early in the morning to late at night when we're waiting for the system to unglitch itself.
And I think the whole thing of hold the line is going to become the perfect phrase for this year's elections because people definitely held the line. And well done to those really. I'm super proud of them because it was
all
not
of us.
Easy.
We all voted.
Yeah.
You and I voted.
Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has made it clear many times, no permanent ceasefire until all its goals have been met. But as external pressure from various world leaders, including several UN member states, intensifies, and protests across the world, including in Tel Aviv, grow more vocal, one cannot help but wonder how much longer the attack on Gaza can continue. Abject hunger, limited medical resources, and continued attacks on Palestinian refugee camps have angered the world, and yet the devastation continues.
Now, let's move our focus abroad. And we cannot ignore the unfolding horrors in Rafah. I mean, it's been unfolding online. We've been exposed to a lot of really traumatic images and footage and messages. And about 2 weeks ago, the South African government once again approached the International Court of Justice in a bid to compel the Israeli government to halt its military campaign due to the risk to civilians. Now, the courts, in a strongly worded order, told Israel to, quote, immediately halt its military offensive and any other action in the Rafah governorate, which may inflict harm on the Palestinian group, which could affect conditions of life and bring about physical destruction in whole or in part, as the order said. Israel essentially gave the ICJ and the world the finger, and just last week, visuals of missile attacks on refugee camps, literally tents, which it's nightmarish to see that. They're bombing tent camps in Rafah, and those started circulating online. And at this point, I think many are asking, myself included, what more needs to happen before this violence stops? What more needs to be said? How many orders do we need?
You know, it's horrifying and heartbreaking, the inhumanity that the Israeli government has shown towards Palestinian people. What is interesting, to answer your question, how does it stop? I think I can commend our government for the international court action that they've taken. But unfortunately, the American government is still fully behind Israel. It's an absolute tragedy. But, okay, yes, one glimmer of hope that I saw in Haaretz, it's a critical Israeli newspaper. They've reported that a party founded by Benny Gantz is calling for an early election. And there've been massive popular protests on the streets of Israel by ordinary Israeli people who are highly critical of Benjamin Netanyahu and highly critical of how the Israeli government has dealt with Hamas. So the demonstrators are asking for them to negotiate for an end to the conflict and for the release of those remaining hostages. Mm. But it sounds like a very, very tone-deaf government. You know, I was going to say, you know, there's an accusation that, I know it was horrible. The attack on October 7th was horrible. But the retaliation for that attack, I mean, so many people, over like 35,000 people dead, like 87,000 wounded. Why does the world allow this to continue? Why aren't more people in the world actually asking for this to stop? I mean, like, yeah.
You've just mentioned that the US is kind of sticking to its proverbial guns in this instance, but there are some good developments, as you've said as well. The UN member states, including Spain, Norway, and Ireland, have now formally recognized a Palestinian state. So far, more than 140 UN member states now recognize a Palestinian state. And this is, I think, very important because it allows, obviously, Palestine to then have voting power. It allows it to control its borders. But I'm hoping that with this move from the UN states, that it also sends a strong message to the US, who has, up until now, refused to condemn Israel's attack on civilians. They keep referring to the red line and saying that they will cease funding and cease providing weapons once Israel crosses this so-called mythical red line that the US happily just keeps moving forward as they go. But I think this move from the UN states also reignites hope that there are still things that governments can do to perhaps push things towards a direction where some kind of resolution is possible.
I mean, the students all over the US are taking a stand, but the US government is not taking. I mean, it's the US government's interests in the Middle East. It's clearly not a humanitarian foreign policy. Hmm. It's about protecting U.S. interests in the Middle East, you know. And, yeah, I don't know how you cannot have a heart for seeing a people bombarded the way the Palestinian people have been. Homes blasted into smithereens. How does a child growing up with that turn up not angry, not wanting to actually pick up arms or a Molotov cocktail? It's like, how do you not understand that war breeds war and that inhumanity breeds inhumanity? How can you still be inhumane?
Yes, exactly. Look, I don't care on which side of the debate our listeners are. In this instance, you have to be on the side of humanity. And what's unfolding in Gaza is certainly not humane in any way. And I think that's at the very core of this conversation.
Yeah, but we're both saying that. We're absolutely both saying that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, it's a very polarizing topic. And I'm sorry, how can we not be humane? How can we not actually stand on the side of humanity? And, Yes, I'm agreeing it was very inhumane what Hamas had done to the Israeli people. But this retaliation is also inhumane, and it's got to stop.
Very few of us enjoy going to the dentist, whether it's just an annual checkup or something more invasive, such as fixing a cavity or getting dental crowns. It's something we'd much rather avoid altogether if we could. Now, a new intravenous drug aims to do exactly that. Now, I want us to wrap up today's show with a somewhat quirky bit of science news. And for our listeners, I just want to say, like, imagine an intravenous treatment that could help individuals regrow teeth. It sounds impossible, but researchers at Kyoto University Hospital in Japan have been working on the world's first tooth regrowing drug for a number of years, and human trials are now starting. They're actually starting in September this year. It's a fascinating bit of research, and I know you loved the story as much as I did when we initially prepared for today's show. What's your take on regrowing teeth by basically taking an IV?
I think it's absolutely amazing. It'll be incredible if it can actually happen. That as opposed to dentures. Can you imagine?
Imagine.
I mean, you have to have dentures or implants. I mean, it is so painful having to... I mean, my mother had dentures. I mean, when she'd laugh, they'd fall out. And implants, I mean, the pain of it. And they go, I think it would be so incredible if we could actually, you know, grow teeth. Look, I mean, hopefully it will be affordable for everybody. Everyone sometime in their life has tooth problems, loses a tooth either accidentally or through decay. And wow, it'd be incredible, I think.
Some of our listeners are maybe scratching their heads and thinking, like, why the heck would I want to waste my time with something like this? But the benefits of this drug, I mean, it can change our approach to dentistry, but I'm also kind of wondering if lessons can be learned in the development of this specific drug in how we treat various bone-related problems, because that would be amazing. You know, imagine like osteoporosis or arthritis or things like that, and how the bones function, if maybe it can be applied in that way.
Yes, it would be incredible. Like kneecap surgery, etc.
Yes, or hip replacements, spinal fusions, which are always the last resort. Imagine if you can replace that very invasive process with this. I mean, it's amazing.
No, I think it's very exciting research. They say it's going to happen by 2030, if it could possibly be rolled out. And it's worked with ferrets and mice.
Yeah, I found that very interesting to see, especially the ferrets. I don't think I've seen a lot of trials on ferrets before, which was interesting for me in itself. But some people are joking online, obviously saying, okay, but how do you stop it from growing, you know? Which is the other side. So I hope
you can have very long teeth.
That side.
We'll look like walruses.
Yes. Oh dear. But yeah, on that very happy note and very interesting note, I think that's a great way to end today's show. It's been a very lively discussion, very controversial in parts, which I think will definitely leave people talking and tweeting a lot. So yeah, thank you so much. It has been an absolutely wonderful chat, and I always adore chatting to you because your insights are just so great. Good luck to everyone out there and stay strong.
Cheers.
Awesome.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. Catch us again next week for another Whole Week Wrap. Until then, why not join the conversation on Twitter, Facebook, and everywhere else? We always love hearing from you.